Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We have a federal holiday learning program which takes place at every federal holiday. But some or other it seems to me that this one is eclipsing all of the other ones which we had for the year. Okay, bad pun. Okay. It is my pleasure and my honor to have Rabbi Jacob Goodman join me to do this program. Usually, we don't do a visual element with it. But since the topic is the eclipse, we felt that it would need some explanation, etc. It is my pleasure to be with Rabbi Goodman together. Baruch Hashem, we've been chavrusas for this year. It's been, besides being a graduate student right now in engineering, he's also a tremendous Talmud Chacham. It's been quite a pleasure to learn with him this year together. And he happens to be very good with the understanding science, etc. And therefore, it's been. I asked him he would join me and collaborate on this topic. So we're going to do the shiur in three parts. There'll be the introduction, then the first presentation, visual presentation, and then the second one, and then the third one. If anybody does not have a copy of the handout, please raise your hand, and we'll give you a copy of the handout. If you can't follow the Hebrew yourself, don't worry about it. We're gonna go through it pretty basic. Okay. So, first section over here. The question comes. We find Mishnah Brachos. Mishnah Brachos talks about making a special blessing, a special bracha, on the different natural phenomena which take place. So, page number one in your booklet, it's bracketed off all the way to the top of the page, the fourth line of the Gemara. The Mishnah says, "Ala zikin, vala zvois, vala ra'amim, vala ruchais, vala brakim, arma baruch, shekaychoy gubarosei me'lo yolam." So, a person sees, according to one explanation, referring to a meteor or a comet, earthquakes, thunder, storm winds and lightning. So the person makes a blessing of Shekaychay Ubur Semay Olam, Malay Olam. We see Hashem's strength; it fills the world. Alaharim Balagvois, Balayamim Balanharis. A person sees the mountains and the hills. He sees the seas and he sees the rivers. Balamidbaris, and he sees a midbar. Arma Baruch Osema Seberishis. Sweet, please. Thank you. He says a bracha, a baruch, a sema sebereshis. He makes a bracha that the Bereshit is, these are things which the Bereshit created at the time of the creation. Osema sebereshis, the mountains, the hills, the seas, etc. So the Mishnah does discuss the idea that we make brachas on certain natural phenomena. The Mishnah does not discuss making a bracha on the natural phenomena of an eclipse. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah leaves out many other natural phenomena. Do you make a bracha when you see a volcano erupting? Do you make a bracha when you see a geyser erupting? Do you make a bracha on a waterfall? The Mishnah has many other examples of these phenomenal, spectacular phenomena which we see in nature, and the Mishnah does not discuss making a bracha on these things. If you look at page 2, we have the Mishnah is codified in the Halakha. This is an Arachayim Simon Reish Chav Zayin. So it says, "Al azikim v'hukim in koichav hayar kecheitz baruch hashemayim imakum l'makum v'nim shach aray kishavit." It's a comet. "V'al ra'odus ha'oritz," which is an earthquake. "V'al abrokim, v'al ra'amim, v'al ruchais shenoshu b'zav," on lightning, on thunder, and on storm winds. So the more it comes out, you can say the bracha of Osama Seberishis and all of these. So you have a choice what bracha to make. But the Mishnah again does not mention any other, the Shulchan Aruch does not mention any of these other phenomena. So the question which we have to understand is, do we assume that this list is an exhaustive list and it's only these phenomena, that's it? And these phenomena are things. So some of them are things which we can go back and assume that these happened at the time of my separation. There was stars moving around, and there was the wind blowing, etc. And therefore, this approximates what happened then. And it's, therefore, it's only these specific things. And the Chazal made this an exhaustive list. There's nothing else included in this list. So if I see a waterfall, unless it goes under the rule of making a bracha on a river, so I can't make a bracha on the Niagara versus Masa Bereshis, because I didn't. It's not, you know, we have the question: do you make a bracha on a river? So specifically by rivers, which I did not put here in the packet, there's a discussion. It has to be Oisa Masa Bereshis. It has to be where it is the time of creation. And one of the Rishonim, the Rebbe of the Rush, the Maharam of Rittenberg, says that since we know that rivers wander and move and meander, so we cannot assume that the river necessarily is in its original place. You do not make a bracha on a river. So therefore, here we are, that I'm standing by Niagara Falls, which is this phenomenal experience, and you don't make a bracha because of a river. Well, maybe you should make a bracha because it's a waterfall. Never says anywhere that you make brachas on waterfalls. You could argue over there, and I actually saw one suggestion that really Niagara River is really the place where Lake Ontario and Lake Erie meet, sort of. Well, there's a little bit of a river in between. So maybe we could argue it goes into the rule of making a bracha on yamim, and you make a bracha on, and a yam would include something the size of Lake Erie or Lake Ontario is large enough. Okay, it's a question one way or the other. But the idea of making a bracha on a waterfall is not mentioned. So what about making a bracha on an eclipse? So this actually is a modern day discussion amongst the poskim, whether you make a bracha on an eclipse or not. And because it's a discussion, we have a rule when it comes any time you have a question about making a bracha, you would make the bracha without Hashem's name. You say Baruch, Melech Olam, or you say Maaseh Bereshis. You would not say Hashem's name because the subject bracha is Lahok, you cannot say Hashem's name. And that seems to be the approach which the poskim, see, even though this is the experience I remember, I'm old enough to remember an eclipse. It wasn't a total eclipse, it was a partial eclipse, and it's a phenomenal experience. But we don't have an actual definite bracha that we're going to say in that. So just to bring out now, at this point, just to bring out the understanding, the wisdom which is included in it, we're going to touch on least on the first part of the presentation. What's your time for this?
Okay, so the first thing to clarify is what exactly is going on during an eclipse. Many of us know this, but basically there are two types of eclipses. We have a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse. There are actually a few ways a solar eclipse as well as a lunar eclipse can take place, but the basic idea is that you have the shadow of either the moon or the earth blocking the light hitting a particular body in question. So during a solar eclipse, the moon shadow passes over the earth. And there's two distinct parts of that shadow. One is the umbra, which is where you would have a total eclipse, and the other is the penumbra, which if there's a partial eclipse, you can see part of the moon blocked, excuse me, part of the sun blocked. There's two other types of eclipses, which are annular, where the shadow, that umbra, doesn't fully reach the earth, and you still see, you can see the edge of the sun around the moon, and there's actually something called a hybrid eclipse. So lunar eclipse, the moon is in the opposite position relative to the sun and the earth, and in this case the earth's shadow is blocking the moon, you can't see it. So what does that look like? So during a total solar eclipse, you have the disk of the moon completely blocking the sun. All that's visible is the white rim, which is called the corona. And in a lunar eclipse, I couldn't really give you a picture of a total lunar eclipse because you wouldn't see anything. So here's a partial lunar eclipse, and you can see the disk of the Earth's shadow beginning to encroach on the moon. So the progression of solar eclipse, you know, if you watch it, if you've ever seen it, it starts out early in the day. You can kind of see the disk of the moon slowly beginning to cover the sun. It reaches totality. After totality, is like this diamond ring effect where you see the sunlight bursting over the corner. And then the moon proceeds to move out of the path and have normal sunlight again. So something very interesting about eclipses is the whole thing is really a big quote-unquote coincidence. The very fact that this can happen is really due to the idea that the distance between the Earth and the Sun, as well as the Earth and the Moon, have the same ratio with respect to their diameters. So what that effectively means is that the Earth, the moon has the same angular diameter as the sun, and it can completely cover the disk. If it was any further away, you wouldn't associate. You'd probably see an annular eclipse. You'd see the edge of the sun. If it was any closer, it might block it completely. The fact that we get it completely, you know, this ratio, it's pretty much an amazing feat. We have the translation in Hebrew for the cosmic coincidence right there. And then we'll go to our next section.
So I'm looking for where do we have an application in halacha of the solar eclipse. So we discussed in regards to making a bracha. We came out that we really cannot make a bracha. The Poskim grapple with are there any halachic applications. So one example, which I saw one of the Poskim discuss, we know that a person wears a garment at nighttime, which is four-cornered. Since you cannot see the garments, you're not chayav in tzitzis. So somebody argues that during the eclipse, you don't have to wear tzitzis, you can take off your tzitzis. That's an interesting application. I'm not sure it's a local lemaisa. I would not necessarily suggest that you take it off of your talus for the 2 minutes of total eclipse. I don't suggest that you do that. The time you take it off, you have to put it back on anyway. So that's not an application where we would have a difference, where the eclipse would make a difference in a local. But fascinating application of it is in regards to the halachas of Kiddush Lavana. Now, what does the solar eclipse have to do with Kiddush Lavana? So I'm going to give you the Gemara, and then we'll move to the understanding of the astronomy behind it. So let's see the Gemara first for a second. So the halachas that Kiddush Lavana can be said to, from the beginning of the month, you have to wait a few days till it's visible enough that you can benefit from the light. Now, if you live in a society where they do not have light pollution, and there was basically it was pitch black at nighttime. You can imagine that even after a few days of the new moon, it's large enough that you would start benefiting from the light of the new moon. So after 3 days, according to one opinion, that's enough time. 3 days from the time of what's known as the Marlin or conjunction, we'll see what that is. From after 3 days already, there's enough light to make the bracha. You can make a bracha that Hashem gave us the Lavana. We refer to that as Kiddush Lavana. How long do you have? So we're looking at page number 3, at the bottom, all the way to the bottom, it's 5 lines up from the bottom, bracketed off, Omer of Acha Bar Chanina, Omer of Asi, Omer of Birchanon, Ad Kama Mavorkin Ala Chodesh. How long do you have to make the bracha on the new moon? So the Gemara says, Asha Tismala Pigimasa. So until the Pigam, the part which is lacking, is filled. Vekama, how much is that? The more brings a disagreement. Omer Rabbi Yaakov or Idi Omer Rabbi Yehuda at Shiva. So the first opinion says you have till the first quarter, till 7 days, which is the first. So it starts off as a crescent, and then it fills up. That the crescent is no longer a crescent. Now it's a full half moon, right? So that's the end of the first quarter. You have that amount of time. We say the word pigima. You start out the moon looking at a crescent, so the crescent is missing. There's a bite out of the crescent. So till it fills that point, which is 7 days. But in the Nahardoy they said Ad Shisha Osir until 16 days. So that means until you have a full moon, that there's nothing lacking at the moon at all. So the filling up the Pigam means that to the point where the moon is totally full. The Mora says, page 4, Ritavayu Kibirchan and Sirlu. They're not arguing with Kibirchan's idea of until you fill up the Pigam, until the part which is missing. They're just arguing, the question is, do you want to make it like the bow, your bow and arrow? It starts out with just a crescent until you fill the point between the string of your bow and the bow, all of it is filled. So that's your first quarter, the half moon. And one other one says it's like a sieve, which is round, it means the full moon. So that's the Mora says. Now the Mora, going back to page 3, the last words on the page. So Nardoi says Ad Shisha Osir until 16 days. Now we know the 16 days is already actually after the point of the full moon. So what does Ad Shisha Osir mean? How do we understand Ad Shisha Osir? So skip page 5 for a moment. Let's go to page 6. So. This is the tour. The tour is a foundation for a lot of our halacha. So he says two things. He says, number one, I bracket it off in the tour, which is in the large block print of the top of the page. The large block print at the top of the page. When you say till the 16th, so that means, are we talking about days on the calendar? We're talking about from the time known as the merlid, which is the moment of conjunction, where the moon is in its full, its real new moon state, reality. So he says that you count from the merlid, and actually, if you go back a line before that, it says two lines before the merlid. Hadoy amri ad yudvav v'lo yudvav b'chlal. So it means till the 16th, but not including the 16th. It means you have 15 days. So you have 15 24-hour periods, according to the Torah. You have 15 24-hour periods for the person to be able to say Kiddush Levana. So we calculate from the moment of conjunction, 15 24-hour periods. So how is this brought down in Halacha? Page 7. So the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Tav Chavav. So the Shulchan Aruch codifies this and says, until when can you make the... This is in Sif Gimel, so it's three lines, again, the top, the large print on the top, three lines up. So when can you make the bracha? Till the 16th, but not including 16th. It means the end of 15, 24-hour periods, and that's it. But vein l'kadosh ela ad chatzi chavtes yudbeis tafshin tzadik gimel min ha-merlid. However, the Ramah adds that you don't have 15 full days, really. You don't have 15, 24-hour periods. You have half of 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 chalakim. So when they announce in the shul, and you have your calendar over there, and they announce in the shul when the merlid is, so they use it, this calculation from merlid to merlid of, we'll see it in the Gemara in a moment, of 29 days, 12 hours, 793 chalakim. Now, there are 18 chalakim in a minute. There's 1,080 chalakim in an hour. So if you divide 793 by 18, you will get 44 minutes and one chalik. Each chalik is 3 1/3 seconds. So the final calculation is going to be 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, and 3.33 seconds. So that's the calculation which Chazal gave us for the time from one conjunction to the next, from one new moon to the next. So the halfway point of that is the time when you last time you can say Kiddush Levana. The halfway point is the last time you can say Kiddush Levana. So if you do your math, that's going to be 14 days, 18 hours, 22 minutes from the merlid. You would add on 14 days, 18 hours, 22 minutes, and you know that's the last time you can say Kiddush Levana. So that's the calculation which we have. So this is step number one. We have this idea that there's when you can say Kiddush Levana. I know the topic is solar eclipses. I didn't forget that. Okay. Now, go back. What?
Isn't the Molad when the moon is visible in there? So
it's a good question. The Molad is when the moon is actually not visible. The Molad is when the moon is, it's a new moon. And it just the time which we're given is the time based on Eretz Yisrael time. And even that, it's where in Eretz Yisrael. It's supposed to be based on Yerushalayim time, and actually it's not. So you have to actually add a little bit onto the time. So this is a Gemara. This is going back to page 5. This is a Gemara. I apologize. It's a large piece of Gemara which is bracketed off. And the Gemara says, if you'll see on page 5, you'll see about halfway down the middle of the page, you'll see a bracket where the words Tanya, and it ends by the two dots, is a Chodesh. So you go up from the bottom bracket, go up three lines. It says that Ramil said, Kach Mekublanim Beis Abi Abba. Ramil said, in the name of his ancestors, En Chidusha Shalavana Pechusa Mi'esim Betisha Yoim. The time it takes from one new moon to the next is not less than 29 days. Umechsa, which is half a day, which is 12 hours. Ushnei shlishei shah, vayin gimel chalakim. And then 2/3 of an hour, 40 minutes. And another ayin gimel chalakim, which we already pointed out, you would divide, that number is going to be 73 divided by 18, and 72 goes into 18 equally 4. So that's 4 more minutes. So it's 40 plus 4 is 44 minutes. And one chalik. Okay. So that's how long. So Chazal gave us this number. So that's a fascinating ability for Chazal to give us such a number. We'll see as we get to the slides that the level of precision over here is phenomenal. So that's how long it takes from one new moon to the next. And that's how long it takes to have a Kiddush Levana. So where does an eclipse come into the picture? So let's see part two of the visual presentation. Then we'll go back to explain where we can see the eclipse coming to playing a role in when is the last time you can say Kiddush Levana.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Pardon my spacing out. So where do we get the 16 number again? Half of 29 is not 16.
Half of 29. Again, 16 is up to 16. It means 15. So instead of saying 14 hours, 14 days, 18 hours, and 22 minutes, the Shulchan Aruch says you get another about almost 6 hours after that.
That's a freebie?
That's a freebie. We'll see about what the freebie is about. Okay.
Okay, so let's go over exactly what's going on. What do we mean by the Molad? Oh, it helps to see kind of a graphical presentation. So everybody's familiar with the phases of the moon. You know, we look out at night, and the moon changes shape throughout the month. And hopefully we all know that the sunlight is being reflected off the surface of the moon back to Earth, and that depends on the position of the moon in its orbit, how much light is reflected. So during a full moon, obviously, the sunlight is coming in, and it's fully reflecting off the surface of the moon, so you see the entire disk of the moon. And before that point, when the moon is waxing, it's not so much, but it's getting bigger, and when it's waning, it slowly disappears. The new moon is when the moon is in between the path of the sunlight to the Earth, and therefore the moon isn't really being illuminated by the sun at all, so you don't really see anything. And that is the period of conjunction, when it's exactly opposite, and that's when we would call it the Molad as well. So when we talk about the Molad, it's an astronomical point in space where this alignment occurs. So this is just to give you a sign of a sense of it, what it looks like in the sky. You can't see the new moon, obviously, but if you were, this is what it would look like. There's a simulation. This is actually the next upcoming Molad, which is on July 23rd. And this is somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, is where I found it, you could actually see it above the horizon. So this is shortly after dawn. These are ecliptic coordinates. So it's where the sun is traveling. The sun is traveling along the ecliptic line here. So it's going to basically arc along this line above the sky overhead to the opposite end of the horizon. And this line here is the longitude of the sun. And throughout the month, the moon is moving along, you know, a particular line relatively parallel to the ecliptic, and it's changing its longitude. So the moment where the longitude of the moon and the longitude of the sun coincide, that is the moment of the Molad. So this is taking place, again, somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean at 4:11 a.m. our time. Okay, and you don't necessarily see it. This might, depending on where you are on the Earth, will determine whether or not you can see it at all. So our time in Silver Spring, this would be not visible. Shortly after the conjunction occurs, the moon becomes visible just after sunset. It's really the only time you can see it because the sun is gone below the horizon and the sky isn't flooded with as much light, so it's possible in theory to see the crescent of the new moon. So it looks like this is what, if you learn Mishnah, Rosh Hashanah, or Gemara, you're talking about sighting the new moon. This is what you're looking for sometime around right after the Molad, usually like a day or so. You can possibly see the crescent of the new moon immediately after sunset, depending on where you are. Okay. So when we talk about the moon's orbit around the Earth, we have to think about two possibilities. There's more than one, as we will see. But when we measure anything, we always need to have, especially an orbit, we have to, when we're talking about a revolution with respect to what? So one way we can do that is we say, okay, well, the moon is revolving around the Earth, and the Earth is revolving around the sun. When the moon makes a complete rotation, 360 degrees, with respect to, let's say, a overall global reference frame, that we could call one revolution. And that's what we would call the sidereal month. And the global reference frame we use is basically the stars, which are kind of like a fixed background. They don't really move that much with respect to the movement of the Earth and Sun. So we can say when the Earth travels a certain distance and the moon travels, the moon's going to travel around this amount, and the Earth is traveling at the same time. In about 1 month, it travels about 30 degrees. So the same relative position with respect to this larger reference frame is one complete rotation. So the moon starts out here, and it goes to the same basic point with respect to the stars. That's a sidereal month. Another option, which we have, which is what we call the synodic month, is where we don't measure relative to the fixed stars, but we relative to the sun. So the line represented, this line between the sun and the earth, this is a new moon. About after, let's say, 30 degrees, it's going to be a little bit different. You'll notice that the line respect to the sun is a little bit different. It's 30 degrees offset. So the moon's going to have to travel to get back to the next new moon. It's going to have to travel an additional 30 degrees of angular movement to hit the new moon. So that's going to add another, on average, 2.21 days to the month with respect to the sidereal month. So that's an average. The synodic month is constantly changing. You know, we draw these pretty circles and, you know, graphs and stuff, but really, if you go get involved with the dynamics of the whole system, you have all the different bodies in the solar system and beyond, you know, tugging on each other. It's ends up being everything's moving, all these orbits are changing constantly, all the parameters are changing. So it's a really big mess. So unless you like solving large systems of nonlinear differential equations for breakfast, it's better to use an average, and that makes it a lot easier for making our calendrical calculations. And that's indeed what we do and what we've been doing for the past several thousand years. Our mullah is not the actual mullah, it's the average, which Reinhold quoted from the Gemara. So what is the average? Like Sarah Reinhold said, it's 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, 3.3 seconds. And the modern astronomical calculations of that, based on NASA and other studies, is 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, 12.98 seconds. Which is pretty good. There's a discrepancy of, you know, around a third of a second, which means an error of 72 minutes in 1,000 years. So that's pretty impressive. So here is a graph from a NASA study of just over the course of a couple years, really, the change from that mean of the synodic months period. So here's the mean, and as you see, as it travels through the season, the moon actually, there's the period of lunation of one new moon to the next is deviating from the average, you know, whether it could be up to, you know, 6 hours in either direction, maybe it looks like even seven. So you see it's constantly changing, and it's kind of in a cycle. So it's important that we have an average, but as we noted, what this basically means is some months the mullah will occur earlier, and some months it's going to occur later with respect to, you know, other points in the year. So the question is, why is it fluctuating all over the place? So part of that we can understand if we start realizing that we're not talking about circular orbits. Our orbits are elliptical. So the moon's orbit around the Earth is elliptical, and this is really elliptical. It's just kind of extra eccentric because we want to make it clear. But there's two important points in any elliptical orbit, and that is the point where it's closest to the body which is orbiting is called perigee, and the point which is farther is called apogee, or apogee, excuse me. And if you remember Kepler's second law from your high school physics class, both of these are going to have to sweep out equal areas in the same amount of time. So at perigee, the moon is going to be moving, or whatever really it's orbiting, is going to be moving much faster than it is at apogee. And that's going to play an important role in our or lunation period. Now the same thing is true technically by the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. In this we have a specific term, it's the same idea. It's perihelion and aphelion. And again, this is the Earth is closest in its orbit around the Sun. This is really exaggerated. It's not too bad. If it was as bad, we'd be incinerated. Probably at either point, to be honest. But anyway, so part of this point is aphelion. Earth is moving much slower with respect to perihelion. And hold on to your seats. We're going to put it all together. So now, when we have these two things together, we'll focus on one at a time. So here we have the new moon occurring near the perigee. So the moon is in the position of perigee, which is the point where it's moving fastest, right? And it's in line with the sun. That's the new moon. As the Earth rotates over the course of the month, this distance that the moon has to rotate again to hit the new moon, the synodic month, you have, let's say, an angle or a distance of delta A. Alternatively, when the line of the, this is called the line of apophysis, pointing towards the apogee, this orbit, let's say, is going to stay fixed. It's actually changing, as we'll discuss later. But if you transpose it here, which will be later in the year, it could come out that way. What you have is now, in this part of the lunar orbit, the distance the moon has to travel to hit the subsequent new moon is a much larger angle of delta B. So when the moon is near the perigee, you're going to have a shorter lunation, and when the new moon is occurring close to apogee, you're going to have a longer lunation period. So that's one factor in the cycle. So that's one cycle. The other element is the fact of the solar, the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Again, you also have this eccentricity, and you have perihelion and aphelion. So when the Earth itself is near perihelion, the Earth is going to be moving much faster as opposed to aphelion. Okay? So since the Earth is moving faster, it's going to cover a greater distance, and the Moon is going to have to travel a farther distance to go. So the Moon is going to be, it's going to slow down the lunation period when it's near perihelion, and it's going to speed up the lunation period when it's near aphelion, because in this case, the Earth is moving slower, so the Moon, if the Earth is moving slower and the Moon is moving relatively at the same rate, it's going to translate into a faster lunation here and a slower lunation here. So we have two kind of cycles superimposed on each other, and if you remember adding sine waves together in math class, you'll get something like this. And you see, this is over a much broader period of time, looks like 15 years or so. And you can see the effect of both of these. You have a kind of a very broad cycle of variation in a synodic month relative to the mean, and then you have these smaller cycles of variation. And you can see this on this graph here, you see this is the relative difference in longitude of perihelion relative to perigee of the moon, and you can see when they're basically aligned, you have the longest lunation. When they're 180 degrees out of phase, they have the potentially the shortest lunation period.
Okay. So back, we're looking at page 5. Thank you, Jacob. So the Gemara recognizes this. The more the beginning of that bracketed area, Tanya Amar Lehem Rabbi Gamliel, Chachamim Kach, the Kuvlanim Mivase of the Abba. I have this tradition from my ancestors. Pamim Shabbat Barucha, Pamim Shabbat Bekitzora. Sometimes the moon takes a shorter, longer period of time to get back to the new moon. Sometimes it takes a shorter period of time to get back to the new moon. Okay, so Rav Gamliel says that we recognize this, and therefore the number which we're giving you later on in this piece of Gemara is an average time. But we recognize that there is this cycle, which you saw over there, which is about, it's almost a 9-year cycle, that there's a change between the length of the lunation, the period of time from one marlid to the next, from one conjunction to the next. It's, sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's shorter. do want to point out, at the time of Chazal, they would be Mekadosh Levana based on the actual sighting of the new moon, but the Rabbeinu Chananel says that actually, even at the time of Chazal, they always did the calculations for two reasons. Number one, there's a mitzvah to do the calculations, and actually, the Rabbeinu Chananel holds that the Iker mitzvah of doing Kiddush, the Kiddush HaChodesh of deciding the new moon was based on calculations, not on Eidim. And if you learn the Gemara, I'm not going to go through the whole Gemara over here, the Gemara actually goes to that they could actually intimidate the Eidim if they needed to. The Gemara says, you know, the Eidim come and say, we saw a new moon. It says, no, you didn't. Okay. Or the Gemara says, we didn't see a new moon. It says, yes, you did. So the Gemara says, the Gemara, we could actually intimidate the Eidim to get them where we need them to. Because the main calculation was done by calculation. And number one, number two, the Chum would always make this calculation to be able to see if the Eidim are saying the truth or not. They didn't walk in and say, we saw the new moon. It's impossible. We know the calculations. It's not possible that you saw the new moon. So there would be two reasons why they would make these calculations. They would always be making these calculations. And they were aware of the fact, so the discussion, which is before, there is a question of when to make the Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the new month. And Ramil uses these calculations. How does it affect Kiddush Levana? So let's go back to Kiddush Levana. So we said Kiddush Levana is that midpoint between the two molders. Why is that? Because that is the moment when the moon is still in the... That's the last moment when the moon is waxing, when it's getting new, it's getting larger. Once after the point of opposition, the point of the midpoint, the moon is getting smaller. So the Shulchan Aruch's opinion is there's a six-hour period over there that you're not going to notice a difference. If I'm looking at a moon which is full, which is 100% visible, which in most cases it's not, it's 99 point something, 99.9 something, which is visible, and now it's only 99.2 or 99.8. So you're not going to, or 98.9, you're not going to notice a difference. We don't have that, unless you're looking with a good telescope, you're not going to see the difference. So the Shulchan Aruch says, you have a leeway of a few hours, it's not visible, the difference, you can still say Kiddush Levana. The Ramah says no, that once you get to that midpoint, you can't say Kiddush Levana anymore. So now, but it's based on an average. So what do we do in a month when we know that it's off of the average? The lunation is either longer or shorter. So what is your last moment to say Kiddush Levana? When is the last time you can say Kiddush Levana? When we're off from that average. So how would you know? So you would know one of two ways. So we go to page 6. You're going to know. So look at the Beis Yosef. Beis Yosef says, so on page 6 we saw the tour, which is the block print on the top in the middle. The Beis Yosef is in the Rashi script on the top and the left side. So he says over here, Umatzosi b'tshuvas Ashkenazis, which is the Maril, which is one of the foundations of Ashkenazi halacha. It goes back about 600 years ago. The time of Mishum, the Amrinan, Ashli, Smal, Pigimosa, you only get this from the measure from the Moilad because it's only till it gets to its largest points. Italian it depends on an amount. Therefore, you can't use calendar days. You have to use test. It's not Vladavka Tesvav or Yitzvav, El Chati Choftes, Yud Beis, Tavshin Sadigim. It's half of 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 Chalakim. Zemulosa, K nearly. When you died near the Imhoya Liki Levana, if you had an eclipse, a lunar eclipse, So the Maril says, therefore, in a case where you had a lunar eclipse is when the moon is in opposition, which means you have the sun, the earth, and then the moon. The moon is totally is perfectly behind the earth. That's when you have a lunar eclipse. That means that was the midpoint. So even though it might be different than our calculation based on our average, but we know we've reached midpoints. So you cannot say Kiddush Levana after an eclipse. So it'll come after the eclipse. It looks totally full. But you know for sure you are now in the waning stage. Till it's whacked, the moon is getting larger and larger. It's getting, until the point of the eclipse, because that's when it's perfectly behind the earth. It means it's perfectly in the state which we would refer to as the full moon. And after that, it's getting smaller. You can't see the difference, but it doesn't make a difference because we have to use this calculation. So the Maril says that after an eclipse, you cannot say Kiddush Lavan anymore. Now, Rabbi Goodman will explain to us why we don't have an eclipse every month. Why doesn't it happen every month that we have this situation where you have the sun, and then you have the earth, and then you have the moon, and the sun is like right behind us. That's when we're seeing the full moon. Well, why do you see anything? It should always be in the shadow. So we will talk about why you don't have an eclipse every month. Okay, now, he says, so that is Abu Bastama Samkhina Khashmuninu Shemosular Abaseno Shihumal Hashava. Even though we know that this is an average, and that's why the eclipse is not always exactly the midpoint of the numbers that we're using. So what about if I have a NASA printout which tells me exactly when the true point of opposition is every month? So maybe that should be my last point for Kiddush Lavana. He says, no, in a case where we don't actually see it happening, we have a right to use the standard time which Chazal gave us, the average which Chazal gave us. So that applies to a lunar eclipse. Now he says, what about a solar eclipse? Now, a solar eclipse takes place only at the moment of conjunction. That's when the moon is between the earth and the sun. That's the moment of the new moon. So a solar eclipse is a way to tell me exactly when the true merlid is. Okay? Now, afilim ha'yuliki chama, shu merlid amiti, karim l'shalano acharov, even if we had a solar eclipse, which was the true merlid, which was either before the time that we're using based on your calendar, or afterwards, which both of those could happen. So when do you say Kiddush Lavan in that month? Do you say, okay, now I know when the true Marlot is, because I know when the solar eclipse is. Right? So, in other words, we're going to have a solar eclipse on August 21st. That's going to be the moment of the new moon. That's not the time that this calendar gives you. Okay? So now, I move 14 days later, 15 days later, I say, well, the calendar is going to tell me that the last time for saying Kiddush Lavana in the month of Elul is 15th of Elul at 5:06 a.m. Well, according to the solar eclipse, that's not correct. That's not really, you should lose your right to say Kiddush Lavana earlier than that time. Right? So am I able to say Kiddush Lavana on, again, the last time for Kiddush Lavana in this solar eclipse is taking place right before the new month of Elul. It's the new moon for the month of Elul. And the last time for Kiddush Lavana, which is given for the month of Elul, is the 15th of Elul, which is going to be 16 days plus after when the actual eclipse is. The month is not that long. So do we say Kiddush Lavana all the way until the time which the calendar gives me? Do I use the solar eclipse to my calculation? So this is the one place in Halacha where solar eclipse is actually discussed. This is the main place in Halacha. In the earlier discussion, right, if you look, you do your computer search and you discuss Likoy Chama, this is what you get. So what's the effect in Halacha? The answer is nothing, the Miral says. You ignore it because you don't see it in front of you at the time of the actual full moon. When you see what seems to be the full moon, you're allowed to use the standard amount of time Chazal gave us, even though you know that that is not the correct amount. So even so, we don't worry about that fact. So we're not bothered by the fact that there was a solar eclipse, and the solar eclipse will actually change for us and give us information when we know when the true moment of opposition is, the true moment of the new moon is, which will be, you know, X amount of days later, 15 days later approximately. So we know that number, but that's irrelevant for us. So we're going to use the standard, average, which Chazal gave us, because we know we're using it every month, and we know that we're off. So the fact, and that's what the Maril is saying, even though they were able to calculate, like Ramil says, they knew the Rucha, they knew the Ksar, they knew how to calculate these charts that Jacob was putting up on the over here. They knew that, and still they did not use that for the purpose of Kiddush Lavana. So that's where we find the issue of Kiddush Lavana, of a solar eclipse. Being discussed in Halakha, a lunar eclipse is actually relevant in Halakha, and there's going to be a lunar eclipse, by the way, on August 7th. There's going to be a lunar eclipse on August 7th, and there's going to be a solar eclipse on August 21st. And well, you'll see in the next slides that's going to make a lot of sense. That whenever you have a solar eclipse, the chances are you're going to have a lunar eclipse very close by. At least an extremely good chance that that's going to happen.
So the bottom line with the lunar eclipse is we can not be able to see Kiddush Levana.
Right. So now, just before we go to the next set of slides, if you look at pages 8 and 9, so he discusses the question all the way around. What will be if, based on the lunar eclipse, you actually extend the time? You know, as we discuss right now, a case where the lunar eclipse will be before our calculations will give you that the true opposition, the moment of lunar eclipse is actually before the time which the calendar gives you. What about if it extends the time? And that's which this came up, and this was written in Tavshin Nun Gimel, that actually came up in Kislev, the Tavshin Nun Gimel, that actually came up halacha lemaisa, and this was discussed in the Israeli halachic newspapers. So this, you know, in Bnei Brak, they have a newspaper which has a halachic column. So somebody wrote into the newspaper, what do we do this month? Please give me an answer quickly because we need to decide very soon. Right? I made the calculations, and the eclipse will actually give us an extra 3 or 4 hours after the time which the calendar gives us. Can we say Kiddush Levana during that time? That was the question. I remember the exact time over here. I think that the final time for Kiddush Levana was about 8 p.m. and the lunar eclipse was 11:59 p.m. So we started then 11:59 p.m. and continued to the totality was at 1:06 a.m. the following day. So you're approximately adding about almost 5 or 6 hours to the moment of totality. You're adding more time to say Kiddush Levana. So if you had a cloudy month, and the moon shows up finally right after the time it says on the calendar, but before the lunar eclipse, can you say Kiddush Levana or not? That was the question which was raised over here. The person always discussed it the other way around, and he wanted to know what about the other way, and he comes out of local Lamaisa that you can rely on that. In a case where you see the actual lunation, and you see the actual, not lunation, so you see the actual opposition taking place later, you actually see it happening, not that you know it. So in the case of the month that you know it, you would not rely on that. The case that you see it, you would rely on that. What?
You haven't seen it yet. You know that it's going to be happening.
Right, but that's it's going to be actually visible. It's going to be visible. Now, there's a fascinating thought process somebody wants to suggest, which I don't, I find interesting to think about. I'll just throw it out to you. So, I haven't said Kiddush Levana yet, and there's about to be a lunar eclipse. And it's finally clear, and etc. And I realize that it clears up, and it's time for the lunar eclipse. Can I shut my eyes and not see the lunar eclipse? So I didn't see the lunar eclipse. Everything is wonderful, right? Well, we said it's depending on seeing it. So lunar eclipse takes place only a short, not everywhere in the world is it visible. So the fact that it was visible in Eretz Yisrael doesn't mean it'll be visible over here. So can I ignore the lunar eclipse in Eretz Yisrael and as far as make a calculation for America and be very happy or not? Question. And then if I could, which is the way the person can understand that is true, that I don't have to worry, again, because I'm allowed to rely on my basic time, standard averages, can I just shut my eyes and ignore the lunar eclipse? So there's actually one side which suggests yes. I find that quite difficult to believe. If you're actually there where the eclipse is taking place, I don't think the fact that you decide to go to sleep for an hour and wake up after it's all over will necessarily help you in halacha to say Kiddush Levana afterwards. Okay, we're going to do one more presentation on the
I'm not sure where she... This is a question for, but for calculating the last time for Kiddush Levana based on the Molad, which is Yerushalayim time,
right? Right.
7 hours ahead. But the eclipse is based on our time, it's based on what we're seeing right now.
Right.
Right. So, how do you, they're different.
Well, okay. Let me just clarify this one point in regards to halacha. The point, most poskim, there's some stuff are not like this, but most poskim say that when we give you the time for the last moment for Kiddush Levana, that's for Yerushalayim time, and you, since we are 7 hours, the time when we see the moon is 7 hours, that time, and our the time we get to that time on the clock, it'll be 7 hours later, so you don't have those 7 hours. Kiddush Levana ends 7 hours earlier than the time it says on the calendar. So if I tell you that for Kiddush Levana, for the last time of Kiddush Levana for the month of Tammuz is the 15th of Tammuz, Sunday morning at 3:38 a.m., so that means that's in Yerushalayim. Means over here, it would be 8:48 p.m. So Motzei Shabbos already, by the time you walk out after Maariv, this coming Motzei Shabbos, it's too late. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, you walk out of the Shul Motzi Shabbos, it would still be enough time. Because the time we're going to see it is the time we're going to get on the clock, when it says 3:38 a.m., that's only really 7 hours later, the moon is still moving. The moon has moved 7 hours more at that point in time. And we're not interested in, that's too late for us. So we have to use the times, so we have to say, at our time, vis-a-vis the moon, and that's the moment of halachic we calculate as the last moment for Kiddush Shabbat opposition. Yerushalayim time, we're going to subtract 7 hours on our and we're going to say that 8:48 p.m. would be the last moment for this Motzei Shabbos. Yeah.
So wait a minute, but we're not using the same calculation for the lunar eclipse. We're not saying we're basing
lunar eclipses. I can't do anything on lunar eclipses.
We're not basing the last time for Kiddush Levana on a lunar eclipse in Yerushalayim. We're basing it on the time for lunar eclipse in Silver Spring.
Because that's what we see. Again, we know when the actual opposition is. We're based on the moon.
Well, isn't that Isabel's theory?
No, because one is the average, and when you don't see it, one is when you see it, you use the time that you actually see. Yeah?
I wasn't going to say anything, but just to clarify this last point.
Yes.
A lunar eclipse is the same time everywhere on Earth.
Right.
Because you think it's just the shadow is on the moon. It doesn't matter where you are on the Earth. The shadow is on the moon. So whatever side of the Earth you're on,
if it's visible, you'll be seeing it.
Depending on where you are on the Earth, that determines whether or not you're going to be able to
correct.
See.
But correct.
It doesn't
right. Correct. Yes. Thank you.
My question was actually, for example, in this case where Motzei Shabbos would be too late to say Kiddush Levana. Can you say Kiddush Levana on Friday night?
Okay, so I want to clarify too. We'll move into halachas Kiddush Levana for a moment. So the Shulchan Aruch says you have 15 days. So according to the Shulchan Aruch, you still have time. So if you're a Sephardi, you're good. Okay, number one. Number two, the Mishnah Berurah says that even Ashkenazim can rely on the Shulchan Aruch. If they were not able to say earlier, they can rely on the Shulchan Aruch. However, in a case we don't say Kiddush Levana on Friday nights, unless it's the last night available to say it. So for us, Friday night would be the last night. If a person, whatever reason, not say Kiddush Levana beforehand, he could say Friday night Kiddush Levana. The meaning is when you say Kiddush Levana Friday night, all you say is the bracha. You don't say any of the extra psukim. You don't say the bracha.
So then my corollary is, what are the other limitations on Kiddush Levana? Does it have to be after Tzeisah Kohavim? Does it have to be before Loza Shachar?
Okay. So, it's a little bit off the topic we're working on, but it has to be that you're able to benefit from the lights. So therefore, right after sunset, it's not considered that, since there's still light in the sky from the sun, you're not really benefiting from the light of the moon. So the assumption in Halacha has to be after Tzeisah Kohavim, however you calculate Tzeisah Kohavim, where that's already the sky is darkened enough that you're really benefiting from the moonlight. That's why you can't say it the first few days of the month, because there's not enough light being given by the moon to do that. And the same thing would be true by Elos HaShachar. Once it's ready, you're getting the sun coming up, the light of the sun coming up into the sky, so you can't say Kiddush Levana anymore. If a person, whatever reason, did not say Kiddush Levana through the 15 days after the Moilad, in the 16th day, there's some service that you could say it then as well with the bracha. And he actually has a historical case that there's people who believe in not being Kiddush Levana during the month was a very bad simon. Okay? And there are stories which seem to support that. If a person doesn't say Kiddush Levana during a month, it's not a good sign for his health. Okay, so there was a story of a cholera epidemic in Krakow, and it was cloudy all the way the first night, 15 nights of the month. And finally the clouds clear on the 16th day, and that night they're going to see the moon. Now these people, there's a cholera epidemic, which means people are in danger of their lives. And if people, we know that emotion and depression, these type of things, can affect the person's health. And everybody says, wow, we didn't make Kiddush Levana this month, we're going to be in danger. So the Rav of Krakow said, we can rely on the opinion that says you can make it on the 16th night, in order that people should not have that attitude, and therefore it would not create a depression and not make them more susceptible to the illness. Because, actually, apparently in Krakow, there had been a cholera epidemic about 60 years earlier, and the worst outbreak was the month when nobody said Kiddush Levana. It was cloudy the whole month, and nobody said Kiddush Levana, and that's when everybody died. So everybody said, okay, here we go again. We know what happened. Our grandfathers told us that this is about to happen, so they were all ready to just lie down and die. He says, Rabbosai, Kiddush Levana, outside everybody said Kiddush Levana. This is what the Rav did, and the subsurfer wrote a tshuva supporting that is acceptable to do. So in the case of Shas Atak, Skonos Lefoshes, you have Chassam Sofer to rely on to say even on the night of the 16th. Okay, now we're gonna just talk about the why we don't have an eclipse every month, and what does predict the eclipse. And then we'll do one last piece of Gemara, your last page, page 10, which talks about an agadic explanation why we about the eclipse and how we understand that in light of the modern science.
So based on our previous pictures, you could have a simple question is we should have eclipses every month, which would be somewhat disturbing. But thankfully, the alignment of the orbit of the moon with respect to the Earth and the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, i.e. the ecliptic plane, it's offset about 5.2 degrees. So much of the time when you have conjunction, as in this case, the moon, if it's at at this point in the orbit, the shadow is going to miss the Earth. And likewise, in opposition, where you periodically have a lunar eclipse, it's going to also miss. There's not going to be any shadow of the Earth cast on the moon. So for an eclipse to happen, you have to have a certain specific alignment. And basically, that alignment is when the plane of the lunar orbit and the plane of the ecliptic intersect such that that line of intersection is in line with the Sun. So the two points where the plane intersects in terms of the celestial sphere are called the nodes of the two nodes, the ascending node and the descending node. These are on opposite ends where the ecliptic plane and the lunar orbit intersect. And the line connecting these two is called the line of nodes. So as you can see in this picture over here, the line is directly in line with the Sun. If the moon happens to be in one of these points, one of those nodes, or not necessarily exactly all the nodes, even around the nodes, as we'll see in a minute, you could have an eclipse. But like we've seen, this is moving around the Earth. This whole orbit is moving around the Sun, and the moon is moving around this orbit. So it's not guaranteed that when it's in position, the moon's going to actually be in conjunction or opposition. It only happens, once in a while. And when you have this alignment, that's what's called an eclipse season. It means that it's possible for an eclipse to occur.
So you say it's not consistent it's not like every year.
Right. Since the period of the lunar orbit is, let's say, 29 days or so, and to get over here, it's not going to be divided evenly such that you're going to have the moon always in the same spot when you hit the same spot. When the Earth's orbit is in this position with respect to the Sun, the moon's orbit is not necessarily going to be on that line. It could be, it might not be. When you have this orbit aligned, that's called an eclipse season. When the moon's on it, then you have an eclipse.
So what's the average amount of time between eclipses?
So we'll get there.
Okay,
so here you have line nodes. If the moon is at the descending node in this particular picture, you have a lunar eclipse. If it's at the ascending node, you have a solar eclipse. And it doesn't have, like I said, it doesn't have to be on the node. You'll see it somewhere on the Earth in any sort of band of 17.3 or 4 degrees in either direction. So there's a window of what's around 34 degrees that there'll be some type of eclipse visible. It doesn't necessarily mean a full eclipse. It could mean you'll have a partial eclipse somewhere on the surface of the Earth when this orbit is passing and the moon is somewhere within that window.
Luckily, it's got to be a total eclipse for it to impact the amount of it.
Right, because that's going to be a conjunction. Right? Conjunction is only when it's directly aligned. It has to be on that line for it to be considered a conjunction. Okay, so we're going to learn about another month. We're going to have a total of four different months that we're talking about. So the animalistic month is similar to the sidereal month, at least in my picture, and that is if you're going to measure the moon's orbit with respect to the perigee. Right, so after, let's say, a month, which amounts to, in this case, around 27 degrees, when the moon hits that same perigee point, that's called an animalistic month. Now, the thing about this, the reason why it's different than the sphere of the month is this is actually changing. The orientation of that orbit is changing over time. So this whole orbit is going to sort of be rotating, and it actually rotates at about 1.114 degrees per day. And this whole orbit will sort of make a flip after about 8.5 years. So the Earth's going around a bunch of times. Each year is one orbit of the Earth around the Sun. In around 8 and change years, this whole orientation of the lunar elliptical orbit is going to change. And that's due, or it's called the apocidal precession. And I have a picture of that. You can kind of see over time how the orbit of the moon is sort of changing its orientation. Okay, and if you remember, one important point about the perigee and so on is that's going to affect the period of lunation. And precession is, you know, in dynamics, the classic example that everybody gives is a spinning top. You can have the rotation of the top around its own axis, and that's what you usually want. And then sometimes if you knock it a little bit and it's the center of mass is being pulled a little bit by gravity, it's going to start, even though it's spinning quickly around its own axis, it's going to have another rotation around a separate axis. So that in general is what precession means, and we'll see that specifically is true by another type of precession, which we'll see. Okay, so the eclipses as a result, since we have all these sort of things coming together, you have the line of nodes, I'll just go back to the picture. You have the line of nodes, which is going to be changing. This whole orientation is going to be changing, like we said, in the animalistic month. But another important thing is the node themselves, the orientation of the nodes is also undergoing another type of precession. It's called nodal precession. So this whole plane is also rotating. And it's actually, so what that means is it's going to fall behind. These lines, if you shift this a little bit, this orientation of this plane, the point where it's intersecting is not going to be here anymore. It might be over here, or over here, let's say, depending on which direction we're talking about. So what that means is that the eclipse season is actually going to fall behind from year to year. And if you measure the lunar period from one node to the other node, right, we have different ways of measuring the lunar orbit, the period. So if you're going to measure it from one node to the other node, from one ascending node to the other, that's how they do it, is the ascending node. If this is changing, just like we saw in the synodic month and the animalistic month, there's going to be a difference. You know, the moon is either going to have to catch up or slow down. I don't remember exactly which one, but it's going to be different. It's going to be different from, let's say, the sidereal and the synodic months and so on, because again, this is also changing. So that's what's called a draconic month. So you have your sidereal month, your synodic month, your animalistic month, and your draconic month. Okay. So now, with all of these different sort of cycles, what you can come out of this is that, in theory, there's going to be one point where you have one eclipse, and you're going to have all these things repeat themselves eventually. So you have the cycle of the moon around the Earth in a synodic month. You have from one new moon to the next new moon. You have the cycle of one perigee to another perigee. And then you have the cycle of one node, the ascending node, moving ascending node, to another next ascending node. So what the result is that, in theory, an eclipse should repeat itself when those same alignments happen the same way. So what you notice is that if you go and look at the period, the average mean periods of each of these types of months, so the synodic month, we've said, 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, 3 seconds, is the animalistic. Is 27 days, 13 hours, 18 minutes, 33 seconds, and the draconic is 27 days, 5 hours, 5 minutes, 36 seconds. If you can find a length of time where these divide relatively evenly, you should have the same sort of orbital positions lined up again, which in theory would produce the same eclipse. So luckily enough, there is a number of 6,585 days is a relatively even number of each of these periods divides into, with a little bit of change. So you'll see that 223 integer numbers of synodic months is, again, 6,585 days with 7 hours and 43 minutes of change. And so on with the analytic months, 6,585 days with 12 hours and 54 minutes of change, and so on. And this is what's called a Ceres cycle, that when this whole thing repeats itself, you're going to have the same type of sort of pattern of eclipses because, again, you had those same orbital alignments, 6,000 such and such days before that. Now, since it's not 100% an integer number, you have about 8 hours difference. That means that even though it's going to be the same basic orbital positions for to create the eclipse, it's going to be offset by 8 hours, which translates to about 120 degrees. So what you get from that is that, let's say you have a particular eclipse, you can track the eclipses, and the eclipses relative to each other are going to be offset basically by 120 degrees. So the same, it's kind of the same eclipse, the same conditions were there, and each eclipse is offset 120 degrees from each other.
Does that mean it's going to be, that's where it's closest to the Earth? 120 is going to change.
In other words, the longitude of where the eclipse is going to occur is going to be offset. So you have these set of eclipses, and the next Ceres cycle, which is around 18 years or so, is going to be another 120 degrees to the west, and so on.
Start from...
Yeah, go this way.
Yeah.
So all these eclipses are kind of the same type of eclipses. They shift, after the cycle, the Ceres cycle of 18 years, which is 6,585 days, they're going to shift again. Okay, so this is how people, even thousands of years ago, were able to predict eclipses. They had this calculation of the Ceres cycle. So the word sar is actually a Babylonian word, if you've learned Gemara, you know. And also, it's a specific number. Not actually the period we're talking about, but it's a Babylonian word in theory, so we've had this for a long time. So part of the ancient astronomer's job was to predict eclipses because people would get a little nervous when the sun started disappearing, and for example, ancient China, they thought like a big dragon was coming and eating the sun, and all the peasantry was going crazy, and the Chinese royal astronomers lost their jobs, and probably more than that. It wasn't your classic government job in those days. So that allows us to predict eclipses with relative accuracy. Again, there are lots of different factors that go involved in this, which make it a little tricky, but that's the essential idea. So for our eclipse, so this is Ceres cycle 136. And these are producing these particular eclipses. This is unique that these are, I think, the some of the longest duration of totality in this particular Ceres cycle in this particular century, which is interesting. And then Ceres 145, which is the cycle which is going to produce our upcoming eclipse, as you can see, at August 21st, 2017. And that's kind of how we are able to go ahead and make predictions so you get your nice Google map where exactly to be on the eclipse. So here you have it on August 21st. It's going to start west and move eastward throughout the day. In this path, you'll have about 2 minutes and plus or minus 20 seconds of totality.
So we won't see it here.
So everywhere in the United States, you'll have a partial eclipse, basically. How much basically depends on your latitude with respect to this line. I have a map somewhere, it's in the back, which you can look at after. It shows you how much of an eclipse you'll get depending on where you are. I think Maryland's, 80% or 60%?
Yeah, over 80%.
Over 80%. So you'll still see something cool. If you're really cool, you'll be in South Carolina. You guys have like a Ryan Bloom and I. You're welcome to join us if you really care. But basically, it's exciting, and we're looking all forward to it.
Let's try to check up. So that's just one last piece of Gemara over here. Last page. Push the thing. So the question which comes up, and this is a Gemara, the more it comes along, this is again a Gadatza Gemara. So the halachic part of the shir is over. And the Gemara talks about the idea that Rashi mentions in Chumash that they, when there's an eclipse, it's a simen ra. Now, why is it a simen ra? I mean, it's something which is an unknown astronomical phenomenon. We can predict it. We understand why it happens. And the more actually goes, and the more says not only that, the more it says, I can read the Gemara inside, the more it says why it happens, for which sins it causes it to happen. So how do we understand this Gemara? So there's a fascinating sefer from the Maral. The Maral, in the world of Torah, he's much more well known for his learning than for his golem. Right? Making a golem, there's many golems which exist in this world. That's not the challenge. The challenge is to make a Talmud Chacham. So the Maral wrote many swarm, but one sefer which he wrote, he says he addressed himself very much understanding the God of the Gemaras of the which we have, the God of Gemaras. What do they really mean? Many times they're talking in some type of a metaphor, etc. He wrote a sefer called Be'er HaGola. Be'er HaGola was where he specifically addressed two or three individuals who were making attacks on the God of the God of the Gemaras based on different types of arguments, the things which were impossible to happen, things which are the science was incorrect, etc. And he addresses their arguments Gemara by Gemara. So in this Gemara, he brings that they ask this question: how can we say that it's because of sin X, Y, and Z when we know that this is built into the Bria? So the Maral says like this. The Maral says that the Gemara's question is, why is this built into the Bria? As we pointed out before, there are many reasons why it shouldn't happen. Right? If this relationship between the moon and the sun is off by just a little bit of a distance, you'll never have an eclipse. You'll have what's something called transit. There'll be times where you can look at the sun and you'll see Mercury moving across the sun. It's not eclipsing anything. It's a little dot moving across the sun. Right? So moon should do the same thing. The answer is because it's at a very specific place, it allows for an eclipse. Why is it at this angle of 5 degrees? Why is an angle a different type of an angle? Why do we have all these different types of precessions, etc., which all of these play a role in the determining when an eclipse is? The Morse question is, why does it have to be? If the world would be perfect and we would not be putting avarice into the world, losing light would not be something which is logical. The fact that Rosh takes away moments, there's moments in the time of the world where light is taken away from us, and light is so important to our lives, it must be that there's something in the Bria which is causing it. And that's what the Gemara is saying. There are going to be certain sins which are going to take place in the future. Now, then he says, okay, so now we get involved in the philosophical question of, does man have free will? Right? Because you're saying, well, the sins are going to happen, that's why it's going to happen. Well, we have free will. And how do you deal with the issue of free will vis-a-vis the fact that we're putting into the fact that a God knows that we're going to sin? So how do you deal with those two issues? And he has a long philosophical discussion about that, which is not our topic right now. But the point he says about this Gemara, the Gemara is not saying that all of a sudden in the year, we can say, okay, August 20th, 2017, there's these sins taking place, and say, I know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? You know, that's not what, you know, we're not Connecticut's Yankee in King Arthur's court, and all of a sudden, just out of the blue, we're pulling out an eclipse, right? Because you just didn't listen to me, which was how he, you know, overcame, in the story, how he overcame Merlin, the magician, right? So, for those of you who read Mark Twain, okay. That's not what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara is saying that these are sins which occur in some type of interval in the Bria. They do exist. They do occur. And because when Hashem set the world in motion, when he did that, knowing that these sins are going to occur in the future, he put into the Bria moments where we're going to address that and send that message that you're not doing the right thing. And that's the point of the Gemara. Why these specific sins? He says these sins all represent the idea of losing in some way, not respecting the light which we have in the world. So the one example the Gemara gives is when you have the Av Bezdin, the person who has the power of deciding day and night, but months, etc. He's the Av Bezdin. If he passes away and people do not eulogize him properly, so you don't understand the loss of the light of this man. This man is giving light to the world. And you do not recognize that. You do not appreciate the fact that you lost such a person. How do we know? You didn't eulogize him properly. So that means indicating it didn't bother you that he's gone. So you lost light. So Hashem says, I'm going to put a moment in the world where you're going to lose light. And to remind you, hey, why am I losing light? Why does Hashem make the world in such a way that we're going to lose light? Because we don't always appreciate the light that we have in our lives, etc. And that's how he understands the Gemara. So I'm not going to go through the Gemara inside, but that's the argument and that's the understanding behind the Gemara. And that's why we have this phenomenal cycle which is taking place, which, again, if it weren't off in many different ways, were it off, we would not be seeing eclipses at all. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for Rabbi Goodman for the phenomenal presentation. Thank you very much. Have a good day.